I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Unless an appeals court says no, Officer William Porter will be compelled to testify against Cesar Goodson, the next Baltimore police officer on trial for the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. Legal experts are calling this move unprecedented. University of Maryland law professor Doug Colbert offers his analysis at noon. Then we'll welcome Patrick Gutierrez, continuing our conversations with Baltimore's candidates for mayor. Gutierrez has worked as a bank manager, a sports writer, and a community activist. In a crowded primary race, does being a political outsider give him an advantage? And with the pressures on Baltimore's population, how does he plan to attract families to the city? Share your questions for Democratic candidate for mayor Patrick Gutierrez on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad you've joined us. The race for Baltimore's top job is crowded, and the city's next mayor faces many issues. Violent crime in the streets, the Sex for Repairs public housing scandal, calls for more investment in underserved neighborhoods. Today, we'll continue our conversations with candidates vying to be mayor of Baltimore. In a few minutes, we'll speak with Democratic candidate Patrick Gutierrez. But first, as you heard on the NPR News, yesterday, during pretrial motions in the case of Officer Cesar Goodson, the driver of the van that transported Freddie Gray, Circuit Court Judge Barry Williams ruled that other officers facing charges can be compelled to testify against Goodson. Specifically, Judge Williams ruled that Officer William Porter may not refuse to testify as long as the prosecution agrees not to use what Porter says in other officers' trials against him during his retrial, which is scheduled for June. Last month, Judge Williams declared a mistrial after a jury could not reach a decision on any of the charges against Porter, including manslaughter and assault. Doug Colbert is on the line with us for some legal analysis. Doug Colbert is a professor at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. He teaches courses on criminal and constitutional justice, human rights, and race, and he observed Porter's trial. Doug Colbert, welcome back to Midday.
Thank you, Sheila. Good to be here.
Officer Porter would have limited immunity testifying against Goodson. What does that mean?
Well, it means that his privilege against self-incrimination will be protected. Any testimony that he would give at Officer Goodson's trial would not be used against him at any subsequent trial that he faces. And that's where the privilege against self-incrimination required the prosecution to give use immunity, which allows the prosecution to gain a valuable and perhaps necessary witness in the prosecution of Officer Goodson.
So, I mean, essentially that kind of immunity for what he would say going forward in these other trials, not his own, kind of knocks, unless an appeals court refuses to go along with that, it basically knocks out any legal argument Porter would have for why he shouldn't be compelled to testify.
And said somewhat differently, you're absolutely right, Sheila, but looking at it from a different perspective, it allows the public and all of us to learn more about what happened that led to Freddie Gray's death. So if you did not have Officer Porter, or if any witness just decides, I don't want to testify, that's not the individual's right. If the person is a witness to a crime, the state can compel the testimony by protecting the witness against prosecution for anything that's said in the courtroom.
But as I read, part of what I read in the Daily Record of the exchange between Judge Williams and Porter's attorneys, the judge said that they could be complicating their ability to try Porter. As I said, his retrial is scheduled for June, and the judge discussed the possibility of something called a taint team. What would that be?
Well, what the judge is referring to is that if prosecutors were foolish enough to use testimony from Officer Porter, that, of course, would violate the promise of immunity. In this case, which is unusual, Officer Porter's already had his trial, so the prosecutors can use all of Officer Porter's testimony at the first trial as well as any other references that Officer Porter made when he was interviewed, interrogated by two detectives. The prosecution simply couldn't use what would be taking place at Officer Goodson. The tainted part of it would be that in some situations, the prosecution might replace the current prosecutors with other prosecutors to make sure that the new ones were not in any way unconsciously using something that they shouldn't use. I'm not sure that it's necessary, but it could happen.
Well, I was struck in reading that. I hadn't heard the term taint team before, but I was struck that the judge's caution about whether or not the prosecutors might be influenced by something they would hear at these coming trials, the prosecutors who will eventually retry Officer Porter. And this is the same judge who's very confident that jurors can be found in the city of Baltimore whose thoughts have not been tainted by all the coverage of the Freddie Gray situation. It struck me as sort of a double standard on Judge Williams' part.
Well, I read Judge Williams as trying to give the defense a gift, or at least something to hang their hat on, something that they can leave the courtroom and say, well, we might have won something here. Indeed, I think when Judge Williams reviews, if he is the presiding judge at Officer Porter's second trial, the prosecutors are only going to be relying on the testimony that is not tainted, the one that came out last month. And they don't even have to look at anything that Officer Porter is testifying against Officer Goodson, which I should add, most of what the prosecution wants from Officer Porter has less to do with Officer Porter's conduct than it does with Officer Goodson's conduct and failure to get medical attention for Freddie Gray.
You said a few minutes ago, referring to the potential retrial of Officer Porter, you said the prosecutors can use all of Porter's testimony in the first trial. That's for that trial. Some people may think, well, why can't they use Officer Porter's testimony from his own trial in this coming trial of Officer Goodson?
Oh, well, I'm sure the defense will refer back to Officer Porter's own testimony if there are any inconsistencies between the two trials.
No, but I was trying to ask, why can't they use that instead of compelling Porter to testify? Why can't they use what he's already said in a court?
Well, we have this constitutional right of confrontation of any witness against us. So we don't submit the written transcript of what somebody testified to, but rather we require the witness to actually come face-to-face with the accused, and then the accused can challenge that witness, even if they say the exact same thing that they said at the first trial. The right of cross-examination is paramount.
If Officer Porter had been acquitted of the charges against him in his own trial, this would not be an issue?
It would be an issue for the defense to raise insofar as the possibility exists of a federal prosecution, and the defense would argue that Officer Porter is still in jeopardy. He still has a privilege against self-incrimination in the event that the feds came in and decided to prosecute. Now, the problem with that is it's a good legal argument, but the problem with that is that it's exceedingly rare for the federal prosecutors to ever come into a state or local prosecution and pick up where the local or state prosecutors were unable to gain the conviction. It happens only in the rarest of situations where the evidence is so overwhelming and yet local justice or juries fail to convict the defendant.
Well, speaking of exceedingly rare, is it exceedingly rare to get the kind of ruling Judge Williams issued yesterday for a judge to compel the testimony of one police officer against another?
Well, yes, but to use the words one more time, what's exceedingly rare is to see a local prosecutor ever bringing charges and determined to convict a local police officer. More than 98% of police killings over the past 10 years have resulted in no charges filed, and only four police officers have been convicted of crimes of killings in the line of duty that have been upheld by appellate court. So we are seeing something, Sheila, that we often don't see. We're actually witnessing local prosecutors who seem quite determined to do their best to convict each of the officers. And that's allowing a situation to develop that usually would not take place, because usually the local prosecutor or the local grand jury votes no charges.
You mentioned appellate courts, and I should have raised this with you earlier. We learned this morning that Officer Porter's attorneys have filed an appeal of Judge Williams' ruling on this point, have filed an appeal with the Court of Special Appeals, the first level of appeal court in Maryland. Do you know where that stands, how quickly they might deal with it?
Well, and that's their duty. I mean, the defense lawyers are doing the absolute right thing to preserve the issue for appeal in the event that Officer Porter is convicted at a subsequent trial. So they're preserving the record. They're going before a court of special appeals, the intermediate court. If it's turned down there, they'll probably complete and exhaust their remedies by going to the highest court, the Court of Appeals in our state. And they do that because if they did not, then they would lose this important issue. But to answer your question more directly, it's unusual for an appellate court to interfere with a state trial proceeding at this juncture. Usually it's something that they will wait and see what happens to the trial itself.
So I want to make sure I'm understanding.
Sure.
What you're saying. When you say they wouldn't interfere, does that mean they would uphold Judge Williams, or
exactly,
they would just stay silent?
Exactly. No, they would have to say something like, this is untimely, this is brought prematurely, we're not taking any ruling on this particular issue at this time. Let's wait and see what happens with the trial in Baltimore City.
And at that point, would Officer Porter's lawyers appeal from the Court of Special Appeals to the highest court, the Court of Appeals?
Exactly.
And at that point, and if the Court of Appeals did the same thing, does that end it, or is there a further appeal?
No, that would do it. And at that point, we'd be right back in Baltimore City Circuit Court, beginning with jury selection.
And so jury selection is scheduled for this coming Monday in the Goodson case, the case of Officer Goodson, the driver of the van. So you're expecting these two appeals court to deal with it between now and Monday morning?
Yeah, I'm expecting the court to say we're not going to make any ruling at this point. It could all happen today if things move quickly, but I would be very surprised if it wasn't handled that way.
One last question, Doug Colbert. I was angling for a couple of minutes ago, in asking if Officer Porter had been acquitted in his trial, whether none of this would be an issue, because it's my sense that he and his lawyers would be looking for some way for him not to testify, even if there were not a legal legal risk to him, as you pointed out, the risk of federal prosecution, while his lawyers can't ignore it, is pretty low. But the risk to his career of testifying against another officer is pretty high.
Well, it's not only his career, Sheila. One of the things that we haven't really talked about much is the code of silence, and that it does more than discourage one officer from testifying against another officer's criminality. It's enforced, and it's quite dangerous in many places for an officer to take the witness stand against someone else. So we're looking here at a situation now where a supporter may not want to testify against a brother officer. That's understandable. But if he was a witness to a crime, then he's obligated to testify. And at that point, he has to make the decision of either being held in contempt for not testifying or going ahead and telling the truth about what happened back on April 12th.
You've teed up a lot of suspense for us. Doug Colbert, I appreciate your taking time to talk to us about these cases.
It's always a pleasure, Sheila.
Doug Colbert is professor at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. He's been closely following the trials of the police officers charged in Freddie Gray's arrest and death. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll speak with Patrick Gutierrez, one of the Democratic candidates vying to be Baltimore's next mayor. What would you like to ask Patrick Gutierrez? You can be part of the conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780. Our toll-free number is 1-866-661-9309. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Kast. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Kast. I'm joined by Patrick Gutierrez, Democratic candidate running for mayor of Baltimore. Originally from Southern California, Patrick Gutierrez lives in Northeast Baltimore with his wife and two daughters. He spent many years with Bank of America, rising to become a vice president of operations. He's a former sports writer for the Baltimore Sun, and Patrick Gutierrez also served as director of communications for the Downtown Baltimore Family Alliance, a nonprofit dedicated to attracting families to the city through events, education, and advocacy. Most recently, he worked on some of the same issues as advancement director for Baltimore's Archbishop Border School, a private Catholic elementary and middle school that offers dual language Spanish and English instruction. And before I give Patrick Gutierrez a chance to say hello, listeners, what questions do you have for this Democratic candidate for mayor in Baltimore? You can call us at 410-662-8780. That's our local number, 410-662-8780. We also have a toll-free number, which is 1-866-661-9309. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We would love to hear from you. So, Patrick Gutierrez, Happy New Year.
Ah, Happy New Year, Sheila. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome to the show. Why do you want to be mayor of Baltimore?
Well, I want to be mayor because I'm the father of two young daughters, and I want to give them and all the children who live here and everybody a better city. You know, like a lot of people who live here, I'm just fed up with the way people have been treated. I'm fed up with the way our money has been wasted, and I'm fed up with the way our needs have been ignored. You know, we deserve better, and it starts at the very top with leadership. You know, the office of the mayor has the responsibility to set the standard for how the entire city is going to go, and previous mayors have set a very low bar. I think that's something that needs to be raised, and if elected, I intend to raise it, and that's why I'm running for mayor.
So you're including Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake in that, and
yes,
all of her predecessors?
I've been here 16 years, and this city has not been run anywhere near to its potential, as far as I'm concerned. There's a lot of improvement that can be made simply by having stronger leadership and better day-to-day management of city operations. That's what I did my entire career, and as a change agent, I was able to go into operations that weren't performing well and get them turned around. And everywhere I went, the root cause of the problems were always the same, just ineffective leadership at the very top and no accountability and lack of transparency and so forth. So
the predecessors that you're criticizing have all been Democrats. Why are you running in the Democratic primary?
Well, we're a Democratic city. I'm very socially Democratic at heart. I believe that everybody deserves the opportunity to pursue the American dream, life, liberty, and happiness. At the same time, I think we need to bring a lot more accountability and fiscal responsibility to our $3 billion that we have every year to spend. And if you can manage to merge those two things together, I think we can have a wonderful city that gives people a good day-to-day experience that I think we all deserve.
Many of the people you'll be running against in the April 26th primary are politicians. Mm-hmm. They have run for public office. They've served in public office. Some of them have run for mayor before. Do you see being a political outsider an advantage?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's one of my biggest advantages. So my company, I went around the country to fix different operations. And when I would come in as the outsider, I had no built-in ties to anybody, no pre-existing relationships. So I was able to come in with a fresh pair of eyes, look at the operation from end to end, and ask those critical questions. Why are we doing things this way? And if it doesn't make the best sense to do them this way, then we were able to make those changes. And that's something that we haven't had in the city for a long time, because the politicians have all been part of the same system that have led us to these results that nobody's happy with. So as an outsider, I think that's one of my biggest advantages, and I hope to really impress that upon people.
A few years ago, when you were working for Bank of America, they wanted you to relocate to Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you decide to stay in Baltimore, which meant leaving Bank of America?
Well, I fell in love with the city. I mean, I came from the West Coast here with grand ideas to help turn operations up and down the East Coast around. But when I got here to Baltimore, I was welcomed so warmly by the people who live here. As a big sports fan, it was nice to be able to embrace the passion and the spirit that people have for their sports teams here. I was working downtown and could walk to the stadium in 20 minutes and be in the seat for my ball game. It was just a really great town to be in, the spirit, the connectedness. So I met a lot of friends here. I met my wife eventually here. I bought a house. And when it was time for me to go, I said, well, I don't want to. This is my home. I look at Baltimore as my wife. You know, Indio, California is my mom. That's who raised me. But Baltimore is my wife because it's a city I choose to love, and I'm very happy.
And you live in what part of the city?
I live in the northeast part of the city. The neighborhood's called Taylor Heights. And if you look at a city map, it's the very top right corner. And my house is actually the corner because my neighbors are in the county. So I'm defending the city line, I like to call it.
Defending the city line. That's an interesting That's an interesting viewpoint. Do you see a tension between the city and the county?
No, not at all. It's just something I like to say. So if I see people trying to move onto the other side of the line, I'm trying to keep them in the city, you know, giving them reasons to want to stay.
Well, yeah, let me ask you about that. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, the incumbent, has touted the goal of attracting 10,000 families to the city by 2020. Mm-hmm. How do you think that's going? And what would you do to attract families to Baltimore?
I don't think it's going well enough. I think we could be doing a lot better attracting families. I think attracting families to the city and keeping them here while their children go to school is one of the major keys to turning things around here in Baltimore. So whenever I look at an action that I want to get people to do, it all goes back to incentives. Okay. If you line up a certain number of incentives and it's not working, then you need to go back to the drawing board and offer additional incentives. So what I would like to do, for example, is to encourage a family to move into a neighborhood. If they would agree to send their child to that neighborhood public school, we can cut their property taxes dramatically to give them that. Because I don't want their money as much as I want their presence here. Because just their mere presence in a neighborhood, you know, 7 to 10 new families can really start to revitalize that neighborhood organically. And that's kind of goes in line with my entire policy, is to empower communities to grow themselves with the support that they need from City Hall. Because the current method of give City Hall all the money, don't ask us where any of it goes, but we'll take care of everything, that has failed miserably. And one thing I've learned from going all around the city campaigning is we have so many tremendous resources that are just not being utilized as effectively as they could be. I'm talking about people. I'm talking about neighborhoods that care, that have pride, and that would be thrilled to take on the task firsthand to get their neighborhoods turned around if they just had the right support and the help.
Give me a more specific example of a resource that you say is not being used,
right,
and how you would use it.
I met an individual who is running a mentoring program for at-risk youths, and he has been unable to secure any type of funding or even just publicity about it. And that's the other thing I've been hearing everywhere I go is these folks that are doing these great things, they can't even get the publicity for it to let people know. So I really don't intend to spend a single day in office when I'm the mayor. I expect to be out in the community every single day, if for no other reason than to shine a light on all the good work that people are doing. Because as a journalist, I believe that by getting that information out there to people, you can start to change the narrative. And I think that's super important.
Wait a minute. As a journalist, excuse me, I'm a journalist.
Right.
You're way over the line into being a politician.
I get that a lot. Yeah.
I'm struck because, I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. I think I operate from a situation where my identity is as a journalist, and right. I'm curious whether that's yours also, whether that's your identity.
No, I should have said, I guess, as a former journalist, or as, you know, those types of tendencies of wanting to bring truth to people so that they can be well-informed on what's going on. I'm thinking about that aspect. But I've always considered myself just somebody who wants to make a difference in the community. When I left Bank of America to go back to pursuing sports writing, that was just something that, you know, I used to lie in my bed as a kid and dream of. So I had the opportunity to kind of shift gears a little bit and pursue that. And I'm very happy I did. I think I got to live the dream for 2 years. But after that was over, I went back to doing what it is that I really enjoy. And that's just trying to make a difference in the communities and in the people that I interact with.
That is Patrick Gutierrez here on Midday on WYPR. He is a Democrat running in the primary to be mayor of Baltimore. You can be part of this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. You were talking about education earlier. Early childhood education is an issue you have written about for the Downtown Baltimore Family Alliance. Why do you put so much emphasis on early childhood education?
Well, because research and studies have shown that, 85% of the child's brain is formed by the time they're 6 years old. So it just follows standard logic that that's the biggest opportunity to really affect change. And the more emphasis and the more resources that we can put into that key part of a child's life, we can give them the foundation that they need and then start adding those building blocks. But like anything else, you need a strong foundation. And if we can take more money and apply it to that specific time period of their lives, we would see a much greater improvement in the lives of our children as they get older and start to add those building blocks.
So would you rearrange money that's already going into education and focus more on early childhood education?
Yes.
And where, I mean, the Baltimore public schools seem to be pretty strapped financially, and the governor withheld more than $11 million in state funding that they were hoping for. Where would you get the money for early childhood education?
Well, we have a $3 billion budget, and that budget is not managed properly at all. And if you look at the things that I've been able to do in my career in terms of bringing operational efficiency to the situation, getting things running the way they should be, lean and mean as best as we can, fitting what our reality is in 2016, we're going to be able to produce that money strictly from that budget. And then as we add more families and add more to the tax base, it'll just continue to grow. So those are the things that are missing from city government right now is fiscal responsibility and managing our $3 billion budget. And those are the things that I bring to the table.
Fiscal responsibility is what James wants to talk about. James is calling us from Baltimore. James, welcome to Midday.
Thank you, Sheila. Thank you for having Mr. Gutierrez as a guest. I'm a city resident. I pay taxes. I'm really pissed off, PO'd about the tax rate in the city. But my question to Mr. Gutierrez, I'm glad he worked at a bank because fiduciary responsibility is extremely important to citizens. And what would he do as far as concerning auditing the departments, each department in the city in the, itself? And when we have these contracts, like what happened up on Roland Avenue, where we just paving the street, they paved it too high. Then they had to repave it, and then the citizens paid for their mistakes. And they had engineers, and the city had engineers. So when we have these kind of mistakes occurring, our city residents really just shake their heads, and that makes people want to leave, okay? And so talking about getting more people to come in, the tax rate's too high, and this fiduciary responsibility is a nightmare to citizens. So I wish Mr. Gutierrez a lot of luck, and you're going to have to do a lot of work because that board of estimates is a nightmare for us. It's nothing we can do about the way it's presently structured. So thanks for the opportunity, and I'll listen up for the answer.
James, I'm not quite sure I know the exact question you're trying to get an answer to.
How is Mr. Gutierrez is he going to audit all of the departments, which hasn't been done for years, to find out who's doing what with our money? That's first off. And then the aspect of contracts that the city has when they're not done correctly and then citizens are paying for it. How is he going to deal with that?
Thank you. Thanks, James.
Thank you for your questions, James. Absolutely. Full audits, performance, and financial are going to be done of every city agency. That is a cornerstone of my campaign, and that is something that's very near and dear to me from my experiences working for Bank of America. You know, we used to have to have auditors come in every year, and they would look at every single paper on our sheet, and okay, you have 14 printers, where are they, and so forth. So I'm very big on audits. I absolutely intend to audit every city agency because it's going to help me do my job better to know exactly, you know, where we stand and where everything is. And then as far as the contracts, I plan to completely overhaul the way contracts are awarded in this city. Currently, they're awarded strictly to the lowest bidder, regardless of who that person is, as long as they've demonstrated some nondescript capability to do the job. And then after they get the contract, they come back with cost overrun after cost overrun after cost overrun. There are standard practices that are used all across the country with regards to awarding contracts, and those practices are worked very well, and they need to be implemented here in Baltimore City. So the other thing I plan to do is really marketize the contracts.
Marketize means?
Open up competition and give different groups that have previously been shut out of the process the opportunity to bid on those contracts.
Give me an example of someone who's shut out.
Well, if there's a paving contract that has typically gone to the same company over and over again because they have a longstanding relationship with the city, you know, that I have no longstanding relationship with them or anybody, so I plan on opening it up to everybody and not just going by what the lowest bid is, but putting exact processes and procedures in place in terms of here's what I want to see happen. Dot, 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 dot. These are the things that need to be accomplished in this contract. Now, how much can you do it for? So I'll give you an example of something coming up soon. We're going to need a new, you know, Wi-Fi across the city. I mean, everybody is clamoring for new high-speed internet. So instead of the current method of, well, how much will you pay to do this, you know, project, what I want to know is how much are you, or how little are you going to charge customers to get everything done? Now, it's on you, the contractor, to get everything done. It's not on the city. What I want to know is how little are you going to charge people and how many free accounts are you going to allow us to have to be able to give to the those in need? And then the company that comes in saying, well, I'm going to charge $50. Okay, well, I'm going to charge $40 and I'm going to give you 5,000 free accounts. Now we've locked them in. Now they are incentivized and motivated to do that job properly because it's all coming out of their pocket. The only thing that we've guaranteed them is the price that they're going to get per customer. And once we've locked that in, you'll see people will get efficient real fast and they'll be able to do the job much better.
James, I appreciate your call. We need to take a break here. We've got some other listeners holding, and I hope that they will stay with us for their questions for Patrick Gutierrez, who's running in the Democratic primary for mayor. There's space for other people to call. If you have questions for Patrick Gutierrez, call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We will be back in just a minute.
We need to change and make our voices heard. I'll make the difference on that. You have my word. I'm not perfect. I've made my share of mistakes, but for the people, I'm doing whatever it takes.
I'm tired.
Hi, we're back here on Midday. I'm Sheila Castor. You are listening to the song I Want a Better Baltimore, written and recorded by Patrick Gutierrez, one of the Democratic candidates vying to be Baltimore's next mayor. Patrick Gutierrez is here in the studio. There's still time for you to ask him a question. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. So that's you rapping?
Yes.
Is that another job in your on your resume that I missed along the way?
That's another hidden talent that I have. A funny story about that. So I met with a strategist early on to discuss the campaign, and he was telling me, "Well, you're going to need $1 million to get radio and TV airplay." And I'm like, "Well, I'm not going to have that." And so he kind of flippantly said, "Well, then you better figure out another way to get on the radio." So I remember from my high school days, my buddy and I used to, you know, rap with a bunch of friends of ours. And so I just went back and opened up my laptop. And I mean, the words just came out. I wrote the song literally that night and recorded it, you know, soon thereafter.
And what kind of airplay are you getting?
Oh, it's available on iTunes and Google Play.
And is anybody buying it?
I don't know. The reports haven't come out yet, but it's out there.
Let the record show that Midday is talking to all the candidates, and we did not book you just to play your song. I would like to go to Jason, who's calling us in Baltimore, with a very timely question. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hi. excuse me. In Baltimore City, near Greenmount Cemetery, just west of Greenmount Avenue on East Oliver Street, is a block of houses where half appear to have been torn down by the city and rebuilt into inexpensive-looking and soulless housing. The other half of the block is houses that appear to have been renovated within the original structure, and they're beautiful and have a great deal of character. My question, Mr. Gutierrez, is whether he would consider having the city renovate vacant houses rather than tearing them down and giving them over to low-bid contractors to make new housing.
Jason, I appreciate the call. I say timely because it just this week, Governor Hogan proposed a $700 million plan for eliminating blight from Baltimore, a cornerstone of which is, I don't know if that's a pun, I didn't mean it as one, tearing down vacants. Mm-hmm. And some people say there's sort of too much emphasis on destruction. I'm wondering what you think of the governor's plan and what you think of Jason's question.
Well, thank you for your question, Jason. So I think there's plenty of opportunity to do both. My preference, if the structure is viable, is to renovate it and use city residents to complete the renovation. There's a company that I was recently reading about that does manual teardowns brick by brick. They're able to recycle many of the materials. And then we can use local people to get them back renovated and then use those homes to attract new residents, as well as use them to incentivize police officers to live in the communities they serve. There's also opportunities to create more green space. So for those houses that are just structurally untenable, I applaud the governor's plan. I think when I think of the other candidates running for mayor, it's a combined total of 50 years of public service. So they've had plenty of opportunity to address this issue and have not. So I'm certainly happy that somebody has stepped up to finally do something about it. And I look forward to working, if I'm elected, with the governor hand in hand to make sure that this goes smoothly, that it goes properly, and that it's well managed.
Jason, thank you for the call. You just referred to one of your suggestions for improving policing in Baltimore, incentives for officers to live in the city. You've also called for body cameras, for building relationships between police and neighborhoods. And some of those efforts, a version of those efforts, are already underway. What other steps need to be taken, in your view?
Well, I think we need to look at the entire process of how we recruit and train officers to come to the Baltimore Police Department. Right now, we are asking certain questions, and that's getting us an officer who brings a certain mentality to the job. I'm more interested in folks that bring that community service aspect just to the job in general, so we don't have to train them how to be more friendly. And I'm also interested in folks who bring de-escalation traits to the job, so we don't have to train them how to de-escalate. So I think if we can start to look at who we're targeting as police officers, and I think back to like my high school days, you know, playing sports, there was always, you know, the bullies, and then there were big guys who were also the peacemakers, and you kind of, you know, everybody had respect for that guy who was able to, you know, get everybody to get together. And I think if we look more towards that mentality when we're hiring our police officers, and also putting more of an effort on getting folks who live in these communities currently. Instead of asking somebody from the outside to move into a community, let's recruit more from within the community. And if right now there are certain roadblocks that are preventing people from in the community to getting these jobs, let's take a hard look at what those roadblocks are.
Well, certainly,
how long have they been in effect and whether they still make sense?
Yeah, let me. I assume you are referring in particular to the fact that someone with a criminal record, mm-hmm. a felony record, cannot apply or
right.
will not be considered. Do you think that should be changed?
Well, I think it definitely needs to be looked at, as well as everything else. If it depends on how long it's been, what type of felony it is. I know a lot of people were arrested on nonviolent drug offenses, saddled with a felony record. Who are they now? What are they doing now? What are they interested in doing? Whether they can be effective in the role? I mean, my underlying point is to look at every single aspect of the way the city does business and ask ourselves, should we be doing it this way in 2016? And if not, what should we be doing?
Criminal records don't just keep people from applying for police jobs. They make it difficult to get almost any kind of employment. It's certainly one of the reasons for the high unemployment in so many Baltimore neighborhoods. How would you address jobs? How would you get businesses to create more jobs in Baltimore?
Well, the first step is April 26, when we elect a new mayor.
You elect a candidate for mayor.
Correct. And we elect the Democratic candidate for mayor. And then in November, when we finalize the election, that's going to send a signal to the rest of the country and the rest of the world what kind of city Baltimore wants to be going forward. Do we want to be a city that's more of the same, that has kept businesses from wanting to relocate to the city? Or do we want to be a city that lets everybody know we're open for business, we've turned the corner, we are ready to go in a new direction, a direction that's business friendly, a direction that is going to champion the residents and get them trained and get them educated so that they can be qualified to have these jobs? And those are the things that I think businesses are looking for when they decide where they're going to locate. Manufacturing is actually back on the rise again in this country. People are starting to shy away from sending their products overseas to be made. So there's going to be a lot of opportunity for manufacturing jobs going forward. You know, they got to go somewhere. So I want Baltimore to be one of those destinations where companies can look at and go, you know what? Baltimore has their ship in order. They're running things the right way there. Let's go and relocate there and make everybody happy.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking to Patrick Gutierrez, who's a Democrat running in the mayoral primary in Baltimore. Gavin Schmidt is on the line from Baltimore. Welcome to the program.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you for having me. I had a quick question for candidate Gutierrez. We are seeing a lot of proposals from outside of the city, some of which are quite difficult for the city itself to manipulate directly, specifically the bus link plan from the MTA, which, as a candidate knows, is run by the state, not the city. And I was wondering how he would address the challenge, engaging the governor and engaging the state administrations that make decisions that impact us directly. And specifically in the Northeast, the 19 and 19X are looking to be dramatically changed, and potentially with very little feedback from the residents. Thank you
for the question, Gavin. So and obviously... Mm. It's a big question. Is there a short answer you can give about your reaction, your view of Governor Hogan's high-speed bus plan for Baltimore?
Thank you for the question, Gavin. So short term, continuing to listen to the residents. I've been going to these comment sessions that they've been having, these feedback sessions, continuing to listen to the residents and directly communicating what I see as their concerns to the governor's office to make sure that they make the changes that the city needs. And then long term, I would like to see the portion of the bus that oversees the city be creating a regional aspect that's managed by the city, because I think, you know, when you're talking about providing bus service to the city, if done properly, it should be managed by the city. And I would gladly take on that responsibility because I would ensure that it's managed properly.
Lindsay heard us, I guess, talking about criminal records and jobs, and Lindsay has a question. Welcome to the show, Lindsay.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking my call. And just to kind of tap on to the previous questions, my curiosity is, what about the recidivism in Baltimore City? And is there anything that you plan on doing to make those changes?
Yes, thank you for your question, Lindsay. So one of my core tenets is to fund programs that work and use metrics to determine what's working and what isn't, actual numbers. So instead of just spreading money around to as many programs as possible, let's look at the models that are working, let's scale them up and get those programs. So I'm referring specifically to a program like America Works, where you know their rate of avoiding recidivism is like 90%. They're able to keep people out of jail. Other programs are nowhere near as successful. So let's see what they're doing. Let's give them more support to do more of it because they obviously have a recipe that works, and let's just scale it up.
Thank you, Lindsay. You, Patrick Gutierrez, you referred a few minutes ago to reducing or forgiving property taxes to get families, mm-hmm. for families to settle in a neighborhood, which of course sounds like a parallel to the tax incentive, the tax increment financing, the TIFs, that the tax breaks that corporations get right. to build big projects. And there are a lot of people who think too much of Baltimore's resources have gone into the Inner Harbor and not enough into neighborhoods. How would you address that balance?
Well, you can count me among those people who believe that. And so whenever I understand the need to provide incentives to get corporations to come and develop certain areas, but, you know, the waterfront no longer needs incentives. That is a very, very attractive neighborhood to develop in. Anybody that comes in and develops it is going to make a good amount of money on it, and more power to them. We need to use that same mindset to get folks to develop in those underserved neighborhoods that are elsewhere in the city. So the model is effective, but it's not being used properly. If we create those same incentives for people to develop those underserved neighborhoods, then we can start to see more of that development take place. And that's definitely something that needs to happen sooner rather than later.
We have just about a minute and a half left, but so I'm going to try to ask a quick question and get a quick answer about public housing. Mm-hmm. There's, of course, been a lot of attention in the Sex for Repair scandal. To terrible conditions, mold, heating and air conditioning problems, plumbing issues. What actions would you take, if elected mayor, to improve public housing, both the conditions and the access, the availability of public housing?
All of those issues are tied back to poor leadership from the mayor's office. So the first thing I'll be able to do is provide that strong leadership. And specifically, I will work with our corporate developers who have done very well with the city over the years and ask them to step up and help get those repairs fixed in a timely fashion. I would also create resident review boards so that they could submit feedback directly for how they're interacting with the housing department to make sure that I'm on top of what's going on there. I would also make sure that our employees at every level, starting with myself, are held accountable to make sure that the jobs that they're supposed to be doing are getting done. I would put specific measurable goals in place and hold them accountable to those goals.
We're flat out of time. I appreciate your coming in and sharing your views.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me. Anytime, Sheila.
Patrick Gutierrez, a candidate for mayor of Baltimore in the Democratic primary April 26. We want to thank him. We want to thank the listeners who called in for their great questions, and also thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features unique sandwiches and salads, specials each day, all listed on the website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. Tomorrow in midday, Governor Hogan announced a $600 million, I think it's a $700 million plan to eliminate blight in Baltimore. We'll get reaction to his plan from urban designer Klaus Philipson and Sandtown organizer Lucky Crosby, and we hope you'll be with us for that. Stay tuned now for Here and Now. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you've been with us today.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.